My name is Scooter, and you're listening to The Inner Side, produced at KPFT Houston for Free Radio Santa Cruz, LPFM, and community radio stations worldwide. We're going to continue with our radio adaptation of Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger. Recapping our story up to this point, Satan, having been ejected from heaven for not towing the party line, is spending some quality exile time on planet Earth. We pick him up in 15th century Austria, hanging out in the woods with some young lads from a nearby village. He's been wowing the boys by molding a miniature castle full of tiny people from clay. And then he created a giant storm and earthquake that swallowed the entire creation and all perished.
Not one of the 500 poor creatures escaping. Our hearts were broken.
This had a rather unsettling effect on the youngsters. But they've all gone to hell, I cried. Oh, it's no matter. We can make plenty more, Satan replied. It was of no use to try and move him. Evidently, he was wholly without feeling and couldn't understand. He was full of bubbling spirits, as if this were a wedding instead of a fiendish massacre. He was bent on making us feel the same, and of course, his magic accomplished just that. In a little while, we were dancing on that grave, and he was playing to us on a strange, sweet instrument which he took from his pocket, and the music. There's no music like that. The bliss of paradise was in it. Presently, he said he must go away on an errand. We pleaded with him to stay. That pleased him, and he said he would sit down and talk for a few minutes more. He told us his real name was to be known by us alone, but in the presence of others, he was to be called Philip Traum. It sounded so ordinary for such a being. We had seen the wonders of this day, and it would be such a pleasure to tell them when I got home. But he noticed these thoughts and said, "All of these matters are to remain among us four. You may try to tell them if you want, but I'll protect your tongues so nothing of our secrets will escape." Well, that cost us a sigh or two. We talked pleasantly along, and he was always reading our thoughts and responding to them. And it seemed to me that this was the most wonderful of all things he did. But he interrupted my musings and said, "No, it will be wonderful for you, but it is not wonderful for me. I'm not limited like you, nor subject to human conditions. I can measure your human weaknesses, and I study them, but I have none. My flesh is not real. My clothes are not real. I'm a spirit." "Father Peter's coming." We looked around but didn't see anyone. "He's not in sight yet, but you'll see him presently." "Do you know him, Satan?"
"No."
"Won't you talk with him when he comes? He's not dull like us, will you?"
"Perhaps later."
There he is now. Father Peter approached through the chestnuts. We three were sitting together in the grass and Satan sat in the path. Father Peter came slowly along, stopping to mop his face with a handkerchief. Presently he muttered, "I can't think what brought me here. It seems as if I were in my study a minute ago. I suppose I've been dreaming along and come all this way without noticing. I'm not myself these troubled days." He went mumbling along to himself and walked straight through Satan, just as if nothing were there. It made us catch our breath and cry out, but something mysteriously restrained us. Father Peter disappeared into the trees. Satan spoke, "As I told you, I'm only a spirit."
"We're not spirits," said Nicholas. "He looked right through us."
"I wished it so," replied Satan.
It seemed almost too good to be true that we were actually seeing these romantic and wonderful things. And there he sat, looking just like anybody, natural and simple and charming and chatting along again, same as ever. And, well, words cannot describe what we felt. He was back in the old ages once more now and making them live before us. He had seen so much, it was just a wonder to look at him. But it made you seem so trivial and the creature of a day, so temporary. And he said nothing to raise up your dropping pride, not a word. He always spoke of men with indifference, as one speaks of bricks and manure piles and such things. You could see that they were of no consequence to him. He didn't mean to hurt us. You could see that. Just as we don't mean to insult a brick when we disparage it. A brick's emotions are nothing to us. He bunched kings and conquerors, poets, prophets, pirates, and beggars together. Just a brick pile. I was shamed into putting in a word for man and asked him why he had so much difference between men and himself. He had to struggle with that for a moment. He didn't seem to understand how I could ask such a strange question. And then he said, "The difference between man and me? The difference between a mortal and an immortal, between a cloud and a spirit?" He picked up a beetle that was creeping along a piece of bark. What's the difference between Caesar and this?
One cannot compare things whose natures are so different,
I replied.
You've answered your own question, he said. Man is made of dirt. I saw him made. I'm not made of dirt. Man is a museum of diseases, a home of impurities. He comes today, he is gone tomorrow. He begins as dirt and departs as stench. I am of the aristocracy of the imperishables. And man has the moral sense. You understand? He has moral values.
That would seem to be difference enough between us, all by itself.
He stopped there, as if that settled the matter. At the time, I had but a dim idea of what moral values were. I merely knew that we were proud of having them, and when he talked like that, it wounded me. I felt as a girl feels, who thinks her dearest finery is being admired and then overhears strangers making fun of it. For a while, we were all silent. Then Satan began to chat again, and soon he was sparkling along, putting us in a gale of laughter. He told us of the time Samson tied torches to the foxes' tails and set them loose in the Philistines' corn, and Samson, sitting on the fence, slapping his thighs and laughing, with tears running down his cheeks, and lost his balance and fell off the fence. The memory of that picture got him laughing, too, and we did have a most lovely and jolly time. By and by, he said, I'm going to go on my errand now.
Don't, we all said, you won't come back.
Yes, I will. It won't be long. I'll give you my word.
We like you.
And I like you, he replied. As proof, I'll show you something fine to see. Usually when I go, I just vanish. For you, I'll dissolve myself. He stood up and thinned away, until he was a soap bubble, except that he kept his shape. All over him played delicate, iridescent colors. He floated, bounced a few times, then burst. It was a strange and beautiful thing to see. We didn't say anything, but we sat wondering and blinking. Finally, Seppi rose up and sighed. I suppose none of it happened, huh? Nicholas agreed. I had the same cold fear in my mind. Then we saw old Father Peter wandering along back, with his head bent down, searching the ground. When he was close, he looked up. How long have you been here, boys?
A little while, Father. Maybe you can help me. Did you come up by the path?
Yes, Father.
Good, he went on. I lost my wallet. Not much in it, but a little is a lot to me. It's all I had. I suppose you haven't seen it.
No, Father, but we'll help you search.
Well, thank you, but why, here it is.
We hadn't noticed it, yet there it lie, right where Satan stood when he began to melt, if it wasn't a delusion. Father Peter picked it up and looked very much surprised.
It is mine, he said, but not the contents. This is heavy.
He opened it up, and it was stuffed as full as it could be with gold coins. He let us gaze our fill, which we did. We had never seen so much money. All our mouths came open to say, Satan did it, but nothing came out. There it was, you see. We couldn't tell what he didn't want told. He had said so himself.
Boys, did you do this?
It made us laugh, and made him laugh, too, as soon as he thought what a foolish question it was.
Who has been here? He asked.
Our mouth came open to answer, but stood so for a moment. Not a human being, I spoke up, for I didn't want to lie and condemn my immortal soul.
That's so, said the others, and let their mouths go shut.
Impossible, said Father Peter, and looked at us very severely. Someone has been here since I passed. I don't mean to say you saw him, but someone did pass, that I know. On your honor, you saw no one? Not a human being. He began to count the money, and we eagerly helped to stack the piles.
It's 1,100 ducats odd, he said. Oh, dear, if it were only mine. I need it so, and his voice broke and lips quivered.
It is yours, we all cried out at once. Every heller.
No, it isn't mine. Only 4 ducats are mine. The rest, he fell to dreaming. Poor old soul, caressing the coins in his hands, he forgot where he was, sitting there on his heels. It was pitiful to see.
No, he said. Waking up, it isn't mine. I can't account for it. It must be a trap.
Nicholas said, Father Peter, with the exception of the astrologer, you haven't a real enemy in the village, nor Margaret either.
And not even a half enemy that's rich enough to chance 1,100 ducats to do you a mean turn.
He couldn't get around that argument, and it cheered him up.
But it isn't mine, you see. It isn't mine. In any case,
He said it in a wistful way, like a person that wouldn't be sorry if anybody would contradict him. "If they only had 100 of it," he went on. "The house is to be foreclosed tomorrow."
"It is yours, Father Peter, and we are witness to it, aren't we, boys?"
We two said yes, and Nicholas stuffed the money back into the shabby old wallet and made the owner take it. So he said he would use 200 of it for his house, and we'll put the rest at interest till the rightful owner came for it. And on our side, we must sign a paper showing how he got the money, as proof that it was not ill-gotten. It made immense talk the next day when Father Peter paid Solomon Isaacs in gold and left the rest of the money with him at interest. Also, there was a pleasant change. Many people called at the house to congratulate him, and a number of cool old friends became kind and friendly again. And to top all, Margaret was invited to a party. And there was no mystery. Father Peter told the whole circumstance just as it happened, and said he could not account for it, only it was the plain hand of Providence, so far as he could see. One or two shook their heads and said privately it looked more like the hand of Satan. A surprisingly good guess for ignorant people like that. Some came slyly buzzing around and tried to coax us boys to come out and tell the truth, and promised they'd never tell, but only wanted to know for their own satisfaction, the whole thing being so curious. They even wanted to buy the secret and pay money for it, and if we could have invented something that would answer. But we couldn't. We had the ingenuity, so we had to let the chance go by. It was a pity. We carried that secret around without any trouble. But the other one, the big one, the splendid one, burned the very vitals of us. It was so hot to get out, and we so hot to let it out and astonish people with it. But we had to keep it in. In fact, it kept itself in. Satan said it would, and it did. We went off every day to the woods so that we could talk about it. It really was the only subject we thought of or cared about. Day and night we watched for him and hoped he would come, and we got more and more impatient all the time. We hadn't any interest in the other boys anymore. It wouldn't take part in their games and enterprises. They seemed so tame after Satan, and their doings so trifling and commonplace after his adventures in antiquity and constellations and his miracles and meltings and explosions and all that. During that first day, we were in a constant state of anxiety on account of one thing, and we kept going to Father Peter's house on one pretext or another to keep track of it. That was the gold coins. We were afraid it would crumble and turn to dust, like fairy money, but it didn't. At the end of the day, no complaint was made about it, so after that, we were satisfied that it was real gold and dropped the anxiety from our minds. There was a question which we wanted to ask Father Peter. And finally we went there on the second evening a little diffidently after drawing straws, and I asked it as casually as I could, though it did not sound as casual as I wanted, because I didn't know how. "What are moral values, sir? The moral sense?" He looked down, surprised, over his great spectacles and said, "Why, it's the faculty which enables us to distinguish good from evil." It threw some light, but not a glare, and I was a little disappointed, also to some degree embarrassed. He was waiting for me to go on, and in default of anything else to say, I asked, "Is it valuable?" "Valuable? Heavens, lad, it is the one thing that lifts man above the beasts that perish and makes him heir to immortality." Now, this did not remind me of anything further to say, so I got out with the other boys, and we went away with an indefinite sense you have of being filled but not fattened. They wanted me to explain, but I was tired. We passed out through the parlor, and there was Margaret on the spinet teaching Marie Luger. So one of the deserting pupils was back, and an influential one, too. The others would follow. Margaret jumped up and thanked us again with tears in her eyes for saving her and her uncle from being turned into the streets. And we told her again we hadn't done it, but that was her way. She never could be grateful enough for anything a person did for her. So we let her have her say. And as we passed through the garden, there was Wilhelm Meidling, sitting there waiting, for it was getting toward the edge of the evening, and he would be asking Margaret to take a walk along the river with him when she was done with the lesson. He was a young lawyer and succeeding fairly well and working his way along, little by little. He was very fond of Margaret and she of him. He had not deserted along with the others, but had stood his ground all through. His faithfulness was not lost on Margaret and her uncle. He hadn't much talent, but
He was handsome and good, and these are kind of talents. He asked us how the lesson was getting along, and we told him it was about done. And maybe it was so. We didn't know anything about it, but we judged it would please him, and it did. It didn't cost us anything. On the fourth day comes the astrologer from his crumbling old tower up the valley, where he had heard the news, I reckon. He had a private talk with us. We told him what we could, for we were mightily in dread of him. He sat there studying and studying a while to himself. Then he asked, "How many ducats did you say?"
1,107, sir.
Then he said, as if he were talking to himself, "It is very singular, yes, very strange, a curious coincidence." And then he began to ask questions and went over the whole ground from the beginning.
"That settles it," he said. "I know the thief now. Lads, the money was stolen."
Then he went away, leaving us troubled, wondering what he could mean. In about an hour, we found out. For by that time, it was all over the village that Father Peter had been arrested for stealing a great sum of money from the astrologer. Everybody's tongue was loose and going. Many said it was not in Father Peter's character and must be a mistake, but the others shook their heads, saying that misery and want could drive a suffering man to almost anything. About one detail, there was no differences. All agreed that Father Peter's account of how the money came into his hands was just about unbelievable. It had such an impossible look. Our characters began to suffer next. We were Father Peter's only witnesses. How much did he probably pay us to back up his fantastic tale? People talked that kind of talk to us pretty freely and frankly, and were full of scoffings when we begged them to believe we had told only the truth. Our parents were even harder on us than anyone. Our father said we were disgracing our families, and they commanded us to purge ourselves of our lie. There was no limit to their anger when we continued to say we had spoken true. Our mothers cried over us and begged us to give back our bribe and get back our honest names and save our families from shame. At last, we were so worried and harassed that we tried to tell the whole thing, Satan and all, but no, it wouldn't come out. We were hoping and longing all the time that Satan would come and help us out, but there was no sign of him. Within an hour after the astrologer's talk with us, Father Peter was in prison, and the money sealed up in the hands of the officers of the law. The money was in a bag, and Solomon Isaacs said he had not touched it since he had counted it. His oath was taken that it was the same money, and that the amount was 1,107 ducats. Father Peter claimed trial by the ecclesiastical court, but our other priest, Father Adolf, said an ecclesiastical court hadn't jurisdiction over a suspended priest. The bishop upheld him. That settled it. The case would go to trial in the civil court. The court would not sit for some time to come. William Meadling would be Father Peter's lawyer and do the best he could, of course. But he told us privately that a weak case on his side and all the power and prejudice on the other made the outlook bad. So Margaret's new happiness died a quick death. No friends came to console her, and none were expected. An unsigned note withdrew her invitation to the party. There would be no scholars to take lessons. How could she support herself? She could remain in the house, for the mortgage was paid off, even though the government, and not poor Solomon Isaacs, had the mortgage money in his grip for the present. Old Ursula, who was the cook, chambermaid, housekeeper, laundress, and everything else for Father Peter, said God would provide. But she said that from habit, for she was a good Christian. We boys wanted to go and see Margaret and show friendliness for her, but our parents were afraid of offending the community and wouldn't let us. The astrologer was going around inflaming everybody against Father Peter, saying he was an abandoned thief who had stolen from him. He said he knew he was a thief from the fact that it was exactly the sum he had lost, which Father Peter pretended he had found. In the afternoon of the fourth day after the catastrophe, old Ursula appeared at our house and asked for some washing to do. Margaret had not enough to eat and was growing weak. Ursula was growing weak herself and showed it, and she ate the food that was offered to her like a starving person, but could not be persuaded to carry any home for Margaret, who would not eat charity food. She took some clothes down to the stream to wash them, but when we saw from the window that handling the bat was too much for her strength, she was called back and offered a trifle of money. She said to protect Margaret's pride, she would explain that she had found it in the road, and to keep it from being a lie and damning her soul, she got me to drop it while she watched,
and then she came along, picked it up, and went her way. Like the rest of the village, she could tell everyday lies fast enough and without taking any precautions against the fire and brimstone on their account. But this was a new kind of lie, and it had a dangerous look, because she hadn't any practice at it. After a week's practice, it wouldn't have given her any trouble. I was troubled. How could Margaret live? Ursula could not find a coin in the road every day, and I was ashamed, too, for not being near Margaret, so in need of friends. But that was my parents' fault, not mine. I couldn't help it. I was walking along the path, feeling very downhearted, when a most cheery and tingling sensation went rippling through me. I knew by that sign that Satan was nearby. Next moment, he was alongside of me, and I was telling him all my trouble and what had been happening to Margaret and her uncle. While we were talking, we turned a curve and saw old Ursula resting in the shade of a tree, and she had a lean, stray kitten in her lap and was petting it. I asked her where she got it, and she said it came out of the woods and followed her, and probably had no mother or friends, and she was going to take it home and care for it. Satan said to her, "I understand you're very poor. Why do you want to add another mouth to feed? Why don't you give it to some rich person?" Ursula bristled at this and said, "Perhaps you would like to have it. You must be rich with your fine clothes and quality airs." Then she sniffed and said, "Give it to the rich. The idea. The rich don't care for anybody but themselves. It's only the poor that have feeling for the poor and help them. The poor and God. God will provide for this kitten." "What makes you think so?" said Satan. Ursula's eyes snapped with anger. "Because I know it," she said. "Not a sparrow falls to the ground without his seeing it." Satan replied, "But it falls, just the same. What good is seeing it fall?" Old Ursula's jaws worked, but could get no words out for the moment. She was so horrified. When she got her tongue, she stormed out. "Go about your business, or I'll take a stick to you." I could not speak. I was so scared. I knew that with his notions about the human race, Satan would consider it a matter of no consequence to strike her dead, there being plenty more. But my tongue stood still. I could give her no warning. But nothing happened. Satan remained tranquil and indifferent. I suppose he could not be insulted by Ursula any more than the king could be insulted by a ladybug. The old woman jumped to her feet when she made the remark. It had been many years since she moved that fast. That was Satan's influence. He was a fresh breeze to the weak and the sick. His presence affected even the lean kitten, and it skipped to the ground and began to chase a leaf. This surprised Ursula, and she stood looking at the creature, nodding her head in wonder, her anger quite forgotten. "What's come over it?" she said. "A while ago, it could hardly walk." "You've not seen a kitten of that breed before," said Satan. Ursula was not proposing to be friendly with a mocking stranger. She gave him an ungentle look and retorted, "Who asked you to come here and pester me? I'd like to know. What do you know about what I've seen and haven't seen?" Satan replied, "You haven't seen a kitten with the hair spines on its tongue pointing to the front, have you?" "No, nor you either." "Well, examine this one and see." Ursula was become pretty spry, but the kitten was spryer. She couldn't catch it and had to give up. And then Satan said, "Give it a name and maybe it will come." Ursula tried several names, but the kitten was not interested. "Call it Agnes. Try that." The creature answered to the name and came. Ursula examined its tongue. "Upon my word, it's true," she said. "I have not seen this kind of cat before. Is it yours?" "No," replied Satan. "Then how did you know its name?" "All cats of that breed are named Agnes. They will answer to no other name." Ursula was impressed. "It is the most wonderful thing." Then a shadow of trouble came into her face, for her superstitions were aroused, and she reluctantly put the creature down, saying, "I suppose I must let it go. I'm not afraid, no. Not exactly, though the priests, well, I've heard people, and besides, it's well now and can take care of itself." She sighed and turned to go, murmuring, "It's such a pretty one, too, and would be such company. The house is so sad and lonesome these troubled days. The old master in jail." "It seems a pity not to keep it," said Satan. Ursula turned quickly, just as if she were hoping someone would encourage her. "Why?" she asked wistfully. "Because this breed brings luck." "Does it? Is it true? Young man, do you know it to be true? How does it bring luck?" Well, it brings money anyway, said Satan. Ursula looked disappointed. Money? A cat bring money? The idea! You could never sell it here. People do not buy cats here. One can't even give them away. She turned to go. I didn't mean sell it. This kind is called the lucky cat. Its owner finds 4 silver groschen in his pocket every morning. I saw the indignation rising in the woman's face. She was insulted. This boy was making fun of her. She thrust her hands into her pockets and straightened up to give him a piece of her mind. Her temper was all up and hot. Her mouth came open and let out 3 words of a bitter sentence. Then it fell silent, and the anger in her face turned to surprise or wonder or fear or something, and she slowly brought out her hands from her pockets and opened them and held them. In one lay 4 silver groschen. She gazed a little while, perhaps to see if the groschen would vanish away, and then she said fervently, It's true! It's true! And I'm ashamed! I beg forgiveness! Oh, dear master and benefactor! And she ran to Satan and kissed his hand over and over, according to the Austrian custom. In her heart, she probably believed it was a witch cat and an agent of the devil. But no matter. It was all the more certain to be able to keep its contract and furnish a daily good living for the family. For in matters of finance, even the most pious of our peasants would have more confidence in an arrangement with the devil than with an angel. Ursula started homeward, Agnes in her arms. I said to Satan, I wish I had her privilege of seeing Margaret. Then I caught my breath, for there we were. There in the parlor, and Margaret standing looking at us, astonished. She was feeble and pale, and I knew that would change in Satan's glow, and so it did. I introduced Satan, that is, Philip Traum, and we sat down and talked. There was no constraint. We were simple folk in our village, and when a stranger was a pleasant person, we were soon friends. Margaret wondered how we got in without her hearing us. Traum said the door was open, and we walked in and waited until she turned around to greet us. This was not true. No door was open. But no matter. What Satan wished a person to believe, that person was sure to believe. So Margaret was quite satisfied with the explanation. By then, her mind was on Traum anyway. She couldn't keep her eyes off him. He was so beautiful. I hoped he would show off some, but he didn't. He seemed only interested in being friendly and telling lies. He said he was an orphan, and that made Margaret pity him. The water came into her eyes. He said he had never known his mama. She passed away when he was a young thing, and said his papa was in shattered health and had no property of any earthly value. But he had an uncle down in the tropics who was very well off, from whom he drew his support. The very mention of a kind uncle was enough to remind Margaret of her own, and her eyes filled again. But Margaret soon forgot her sorrow. She liked Philip, and I knew she would. And when he told her he was studying for the ministry, I could see that she liked him even more. And then, when he promised to get her admitted to the jail so that she could see her uncle, that was the capstone. He said he would give the guards a little present, and she must always go in the evening after dark and say nothing, but just show this paper and pass in, and show it again when you come out. And he scribbled some queer marks on the paper and gave it to her. She was ever so thankful, and right away in a fever for the sun to go down. For in that old, cruel time, prisoners were not allowed to see their friends, and sometimes they spent years in the jails without seeing a friendly face. I judged that the marks on the paper were an enchantment, and that the guards would not know what they were doing, nor have any memory of it afterwards. And that was indeed the way of it.
You've been listening to a radio adaptation of Mark Twain's The Mysterious Stranger. If you'd like to hear the earlier episodes from this story, or past Innerside programs, just Google The Inner Side, and it's right up near the top there. If you have a dial-up, you'd probably better off going to kpft.org and click on the archive. Look for The Inner Side, which is produced right here at KPFT Houston. And we will continue with our story next week. Don't take any chances. Stick with the devil you know. Which reminds me, my name is Scooter, and I'll see you next week.
7 weeks later. I've been around for a
long, long year. Music by CyberZen Sound Engine and The Rolling Stones.